My guest Robert Forster starred in the now classic 1969 film Medium Cool as a TV news cameraman who remains detached from the cultural upheaval he is reporting. In 1972, Forster starred in the TV series Banyan, but his career never took off. He worked, but many of his roles were in movies like Kinky Coaches and the Pom-Pom Pussycats and Maniac Cop 3, Badge of Honor. But even if casting directors didn't notice his talents, Quentin Tarantino did. He cast Forster in the role of the bail bondsman in the 1997 film Jackie Brown, and that turned things around for Forster. He's since been in Me, Myself, and Irene, Like Mike, Lake Boat, Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle, and Mulholland Drive. And now Forster is starring in the ABC series Karen Sisko, adapted from the film Out of Sight, based on characters created by Elmore Leonard. Carla Gugino plays an attractive U.S. Marshal whose dangerous work is always coming into conflict with her personal life. Forster plays her father, a semi-retired private eye. In this scene, they're on the phone together.
Hi, Daddy.
Listen to this. Guy goes in to rob a bank, tells his partner to circle a block. He comes running out, gets hit by a car. Who do you think's driving?
The partner.
Oh, they say irony's dead.
You working today?
Yeah, guy in a wheelchair. Insurance scam.
How'd he get in the chair?
Fell off his desk.
Well, they'll do that on you.
Every damn time. So, this new guy you're seeing, tell him what you do yet?
He still wants to guess.
Sounds like an insurance agent.
Charter fisherman. He owns a boat.
What's his name?
Carl Wilkins.
I always wanted a boat.
Dad, you get seasick.
What's that got to do with the price of eggs? Live by the ocean? Ought to have a boat.
I gotta run.
Why, you got something to do?
Yeah, I'm back at work.
How you feeling?
Not you too.
I'll see you tomorrow night at poker.
Bye, Daddy.
Bye, honey.
Forster has played a lot of cops and private eyes over the years. I asked him if there's anything in those roles that connect with his real personality.
Probably, you know, these guys are straight shooters, no nonsense, if not cynical, at least skeptical, and, you know, you can't put a lot by them. They've seen a lot, and so I take the mantle of that and pretend it's me.
Do you feel like you're that kind of person yourself?
Hardly. you know, I don't know much. My experience is limited by, you know, most human limitations. An actor, you know, actors do things that are, you know, sort of artificial. Notwithstanding, I've read a bunch of stuff of this genre, and so you pick up here and there, and you know, you pretend it's you.
How did you get the part in Karen Sisko?
I was doing pictures. Now, you know, I had a 5-year first act to my career, which ascended, and then a 28-year descending second act to my career. Until Quentin Tarantino handed me Jackie Brown. And that, of course, put me back in business. And from that point, I was doing pictures, which was, you know, which is the big banana of this business, doing movies. While I was doing movies, I had my agent every once in a while would say, you know, there's a television series around the bend somewhere for you. And I'd say, you know, wait till I fail with pictures and let me cool off and eventually we'll do television. But earlier this year, a guy, John McNamara, who was the producer and writer of a show called Fastlane, wrote one for me. I played the father of Peter Facinelli, a guy who I'd worked with on Supernova a few years ago. And what a great part. This was a great character, and I did one episode, and then he wrote a second episode for me, and while we were shooting the second episode, I was on a hillside overlooking Los Angeles. We were standing by a pool waiting for the shot to get set up, and I thought, if I could find a character this good, I would do a television show, because you realize that if you're doing a movie, 10 weeks later, you're done with that character. Television show, if it's a good one, it can last a long time, and you can be doing a great character for a long time. This is it. Now, the minute I said that, apparently he went into motion, and not too long after that, I received this script for Karen Sisko. And I have found the best thing I have listen, I've been waiting 40 years for this, and here it is. It's a great character with humor, and I just bring myself to the set. I don't have to do anything more than that. They write great stuff for me. Smart, witty, wise, everything I'm not. Now, thanks for the... I'm kidding.
You had been the star of a TV series before Banyan.
Two series. One was called Banyan, a 30s detective. Old cars, old clothes, old jokes, fast women. They all lied to me. That's what they do in the detective movies. And another television show 2 years later in 1974 called Nakia, a good guy, Indian, deputy sheriff, New Mexico, contemporary, cops and robbers in the desert.
Did you like doing either of those?
I did, but I can tell you one thing. It's the hardest job I ever did. I've been an iron worker, and I was worked on the railroad. I was a substitute teacher, but nothing is as hard as carrying a television show. And Carla Gugino, who is the star of Karen Sisko, is the hardest working woman I have ever seen, met. She does short days or 12 hours. Her usual day is probably 13, 15 hours, and I have never heard her complain. She is not delicate. She slugs it out every single day. All I can tell you is that my experience doing my television shows is both of them got canceled half season, and I was relieved. I thought, oh, God, how can I get up another day and face the grind of a television show? So she is champion.
Now, it was Jackie Brown that really revived your career, the Quentin Tarantino movie. It's really a wonderful film, and I should mention it's out on DVD, too. Had you seen Quentin Tarantino's earlier films? I know he'd seen your work, and that's why he wrote the part of the bail bondsman for you, but had you seen his work?
Sure. Strangely, when my career was at its lowest... and I had been doing, you know, dopey exploitation movies for a few different guys who'd hire me. Bill Lustig was one of them, and Fred Williamson was another, and they made, you know, low-budget movies, cop sort of, or horror or whatever. And Lustig called me up one day and said, you know, I just bought a really great script from a guy you never heard of. His name is Quentin Tarantino, and this guy Tarantino claims there's a part in this script that Lustig, he said, was supposed to give to me. And I thought, oh boy, something to grab onto. My slide is over here. I'm going to get traction with this one. And I read it, and it was great. And before the picture could get made, they grabbed it away from Lustig and gave it to a big director, Tony Scott, and he made True Romance out of it. And then I got a call from my agents.
So you didn't get the part in that after all?
No, I didn't even get close to it. This picture was made with real people, real stars. Then, about a year later or so, my agent called me when I had one, who said, there's a guy you're going to meet for a picture called Reservoir Dogs. You never heard of this guy, Quentin Tarantino. And they sent me the script, and I thought, oh boy, my slide is over. This thing is going to be good. This guy likes me. I'm going to get this part. And I went in there at Fox, I remember the reading, and I read this thing good. I knew what I was doing, and after I read it, I walked out of the room. He followed me out of the room, and he said, hey, listen. He said, you know, I've seen everything you ever did, and he started reeling off everything. And he'd seen everything, even the little picture I made, Hollywood Harry. And he said, but look, this thing is not going to work, he said, because I'm going to give this part to the guy that I dedicated the script to, Lawrence Tierney. So I didn't do that. Following that, he made Pulp Fiction and became a great big director. Years go by. I have breakfast at a place in Hollywood, West Hollywood, and I went into breakfast one morning. I'm sitting there, and in walks Quentin. And I call him over, and he comes over, and we blah, blah for a few minutes, and I ask him what he's doing, and he said he's adapting Rum Punch, an Elmore Leonard novel, to a movie. He said, why don't you read it? That was that. About 6 months later, I walk into the same restaurant. I turn the corner into the patio to go toward my own spot. Quentin's sitting in my seat. As I approach, he picks up a script. He hands it to me. He says, read this, see if you like it. Now, there has never been such a gift. He gave me a gift the size of which cannot be exaggerated.
Did you feel like you should be talking him out of it because you felt washed up? Do you know what I mean?
I didn't feel washed. No, I knew that if I hung in there long enough, I had a long shot strategy, and that was that someday some kid who liked me growing up would turn into a movie maker and give me a good part.
Oh.
How do you like that?
It worked.
It worked.
Well, let me play a scene from Jackie Brown. This is a scene from early on. You're a bail bondsman, and Samuel Jackson, who has lived a life of crime, is coming to you to get a bail bond for Jackie Brown.
All right. You want another bond? You want to move the $10,000 you got on Beaumont over to the stewardess? That means paperwork. I got to get a death certificate, present it to the court, make out a receipt for return of bond collateral, type up another application.
Hey, man, Jackie ain't got time for all that.
I'm telling you what I have to do. What you have to do, in case you forgot, is come up with a premium of $1,000.
I can do that. You know I got the money. I just ain't got it with me.
Come back when you do. I'll bond out the stewardess.
Look, you got to look at this with a little compassion, all right? Jackie ain't no criminal. She ain't used to this kind of treatment. Now, gangsters, they don't give a but you're your average citizen. A couple of nights in county get the with their mind.
Ordell, this isn't a bar. You don't have a tab.
Listen to me, all right? You got a 44-year-old, gainfully employed black woman, falsely accused of...
Falsely accused? She didn't come back from Mexico with cocaine on her?
Falsely accused of intent? Now, if she had that and mind you, I'm saying if, that was her own personal to get high with.
Is white guilt supposed to make me forget I'm running a business?
Oh, it's like that, huh?
That's Samuel Jackson and my guest Robert Forster in a scene from Jackie Brown, a film by Quentin Tarantino. Now, one of the things I love about this film is this part of the story between you and Pam Grier, who's your female co-star in the movie. And it's a great love story because you never know if she's really on the level. And also, it's a real like middle-aged love story. You know, she's middle-aged, you're middle-aged, and it's also interracial love story. And it really works. What did you think the odds were that when you were coming out of this long phase where you weren't getting work, you'd get this kind of leading man role? And it's not leading man role in the sense that, you know, it's like James Bond or, you know, or the Hulk.
No, it was better than that. It was real.
It's real,
human.
Exactly.
It was
yeah.
human and
it has
it was
so much
believable
feeling in
stuff.
It. Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and that is sort of what Elmore Leonard is about, real characters. He has affection for his characters. They're human, and even if they're bad guys, he has affection for them and knows that they, you know, knows they have a real life and laugh once in a while and are not just bad guys. Elmore Leonard and Quentin Tarantino, and Tarantino, of course, I know quite well at this point, and I know what his dialogue is like. He took it from Elmore Leonard, but it's really his own. And this guy has a real ear for knowing what people speak like, especially characters and neighborhood characters and people from different places. He's got a real ear for it.
There's a kind of air of depression and loneliness that hangs over your character in Jackie Brown. And I'd just be interested in hearing what you did to get in the right frame of mind for the role.
I had a 28-year slide to my career. Oh, boy. Listen, you know, I must have asked myself 400 times, are you going to survive this, Bob? Are you going to be able to save the house? Are you going to get the kids through college? Are you going to, you know, survive a relationship? Will anybody love you at the end? Is it going to be all lonely, or is it going to be, you know, who knows what? And, you know, you survive it, and you keep on slugging, and you refuse to quit.
During that period when you weren't working much, you were still making some movies, and some of them sound like they were, you know, real cheap films like Satan's Princess. And
oh, what a cutie that was.
Was it?
I never saw that one.
Intentionally?
Probably, you know, but you know, there's some things you just, why bother?
What are some of the other titles from that period?
Oh boy, there were some, you know, there's a series, if you look on the internet, it used to be on, I think they've taken them off now, but for a couple of years after Jackie Brown, there were still a couple of Spanish titles on my website, not my website, but the database. And those pictures were made by an actor who in Spain about, I don't know, 20 years ago, used my name. Somebody told him that he looked like me, and so he used my name in Spanish pictures, one of which is called, and you could find it, and it's a better title than I'm going to tell you, but the witch nymphomaniac from the Rio Grande, and at least two or three of those kind of titles, and a few other titles of my own that, equally terrible and forgettable, but there are some little pictures made during those years that I loved.
Well, you actually started your career with a splash. In 1969, you were the star of Medium Cool, and you played a TV cameraman.
Yep.
It was set in the present. In fact, there were, or more or less the present, there were scenes that were actually shot at the demonstrations at the Chicago Convention and inside the Chicago Convention. Were there things about the movie that surprised you, such as having to film in the context of the real Democratic Convention?
This movie was one of my great learning experiences. Up until then, I didn't realize that an actor might be called upon to improvise. There was an awful lot of this movie that was improvised, and I hadn't a clue. I thought they wrote the words for you. So now I'm with Haskell, and he hands me a camera and says, "Okay, do an interview with that person over there," and with nothing more than let's see how we do this. I started talking, and the next thing you know, you're improvising and bringing the character that you imagine you are supposed to be. I had gotten a great lesson from John Huston. I had
he directed you in Reflections in a Golden Eye.
Yes, my first picture. I met him in a hotel room. I arrived from L.A. I had read the book, Reflections in a Golden Eye. I showed up. I walked into the lobby of this hotel, and I looked around, and everywhere, there were guys. They all looked like me. I thought he wanted to meet me for Reflections in a Golden Eye. This was a cattle call. They called my name. I was escorted up the elevator. We waited outside of a room. Somebody left. I walked in. I'm introduced to this tall old guy. He says, "What have you done? What have you done?" I said, "Listen, I haven't done much. I did one Broadway play. It wasn't bad, but I don't make myself an actor. I never did a movie. I don't know how they're made. I don't know what the tricks are, but if you hire me, I'll give you your money's worth." He gave me the job. On the first day of production, I get out of the car. I'm walking over to where he's standing. He says, "Now's the time, Bobby." I say, "Shoot, I'm all ears." He says, "Go take a look through the lens." I walked over to the camera. The cameraman stepped aside. I looked through the lens. I turned back to Huston. He's got his hands shaped in the form of a rectangle. He said, "You see those? Those are the frame lines." I looked again through the lens. I said, "Yeah, you mean that line that shows the cameraman what the audience sees?" He says, "Those are the frame lines. Now ask yourself this. What needs to be there?" Wow. In 14 words, this guy gives me the secret. The actor is supposed to understand and imagine what is supposed to be inside that frame and deliver it. And deliver what the writer needs and what the director may need, and it's got to be there because the guy who set the lights wants you to be in them, and you got to hear the ones who are listening for the words, got to hear them correctly. Otherwise, somebody at the end of the shot says, "No good for sound, start again." And if you do something too big for the frame you're in, somebody says, "No good for composition, start again." And if you put the cup in the wrong spot, somebody says, "No good for continuity." You've got to deliver a stroke which advantages everybody's needs at once. And when you do that, you get to hear cut, print, move on to the next shot. John Huston gave me a great piece of advice, and I took that to Haskell Wexler's picture, and I said to myself, "Okay, what's supposed to be here?" And then he would say action, and I'd throw something out there.
One of the things you had to do in Medium Cool was be naked.
Oh!
And how'd you feel about that?
You know, okay, here comes the first thing. Oh, what a fun thing this was. I got the script to Reflections in a Golden Eye. That's where it started. And I read this thing, and here it says, yeah, the guy rides around naked on a horse. And I'm thinking to myself, and I'd never made a movie. I hadn't a clue. And I said, gee, I wonder how they do that. Probably trick photography or something. Yeah. So I remember the day I was in Rome, and when I came out to the set, and here was an Italian extra riding around the horse naked. And I thought to myself, gee, that's supposed to be me. And I was so taken in the moment, I said to John Huston, I said, "I could do that. I could do that." He said, "Could you, Bobby? Could you really?" I said, "Yeah, I could do that." I didn't want the other guy to be in the picture. I wanted to do that thing. It was my own. So the next thing I know, the wardrobe department hands me a little tiny triangle cut from a jock strap, all right, and a roll of tape. And they handed this to me, and that was supposed to give me some my modesty, yes. Yeah. And, of course, it unpeeled immediately. So, you know what? I said, Bob, if you don't give yourself permission to do this, then why do it? You know, you either got to give yourself full permission to be absolutely unafraid, and if you don't, you're dead. You can't proceed in this thing. It's like being afraid. You got to overcome fear, the fear of being on stage, for one thing. I mean, that fear of stage fright. I remember the first time I had stage fright. I was in the University of Rochester, and I had done a play sort of accidentally. I chased a girl into the auditorium. I wanted to say something to her. She was in a play. I got in the play. That's how I met the girl. Later, I married her. You have to overcome stage fright, and I had to overcome the fear of doing that. After that, in Medium Cool, it wasn't that hard. What's his name? Haskell said, you think you can get Mariana Hill to be naked? I said, why ask me? You're the director. You're supposed to ask her, not me. He said, yeah, but, you know, I'm a little embarrassed. I said, so don't ask me. Next thing I know, she said, sure. And the next thing he says, well, if she's naked, you know, you got to be naked too. I said, like hell. He says, yeah, because otherwise it looks stupid. Anyway, round two, I say, okay, Bob, let's go. You're not that afraid of it. Let's try. And bingo, bango.
And you're chasing each other around the room, you know, having fun.
Yeah.
Were you embarrassed at all? Or were you not
well,
really
sure,
painfully
I was a little,
modest?
Oh, painfully modest. And don't forget, I lived in Rochester. I had neighbors. I had a mother-in-law. I had cousins and everybody. And you know, I... But, you know, that's what you do. You say either be unafraid or don't do it.
Now, I read that your father, before World War II, was worked with Ringling Brothers Circus as an elephant trainer.
He was on the Ringling, yeah. Oh, what a good guy this guy is. I remember when I went to him at the end of my senior year at the University of Rochester, I went to him and I said, Dad, I said, you know what? I don't think I want to be a lawyer. I want to be an actor. And he, who had, as you know, been an elephant trainer on the Ringling before World War II, did not miss a beat. He said, I think you could do that, Bob. And this guy pulled for me for over 30 years. And he died just before Jackie Brown was released. But he saw some of the shooting. He came out for a circus event in the last 10 years or so of his life. We did a lot of circus events together. They've got circus groups and old fan organizations and some old circus performers. And he had come out to San Francisco, and we did it, a four-day event. And he came here to Los Angeles, and on the night before, he went back to Rochester. And he was ill at the time. He was really on his last legs, and I was worried that he wasn't going to manage. I was worried that I wasn't going to see him again when I put him on that plane. But the last night before he went back to Rochester, he was on the set. We had a night shoot. And at the end of that, when I was taking him to the airport, he said, you know, this picture's going to do you a lot of good, Bob. This guy's very, very good. Quentin, you want to know what a good guy he is, cut some scenes together when the picture was over in days. He cut some scenes together and sent them to me on videotape to show to my father, which was only days before he passed.
That's really
this
nice.
Is a good, good guy.
Just a question about your accent. I always assumed you were from Chicago. Maybe that's because I saw you in the movie adaptation of David Mamet's Lake Boat.
I'm from Rochester, which a Great Lakes accent. I imagine that the Great Lakes were far more influenced one another than, for instance, from Rochester down to New York City, which are very different accents. So Rochester, Buffalo, Erie, not Detroit so much, but Chicago, and almost all those cities have a similar accent, a long A. I know I sound that way. Not much to do about it. Just got to live with what you got.
Are there times when you feel that really works for you and other times when you feel you should play it down?
You know, I never try to play it down. I figure that's what they hired and that's what they're going to get. It's easier to deliver yourself than it is to make up somebody. If you try to make somebody up, you know, it's pretty thin. It's kind of a veneer. But if you deliver yourself, you got your real self to deliver. And what could be better than that?
Well, Robert Forster, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Robert Forster co-stars in the series Karen Sisko. The next episode will be broadcast tonight on ABC. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. 110th Street.